the podcast that you never made a deal with. I'm your host, Bria, and with me are my two co-hosts, Brian and Jay.
Hello.
Hello.
On today's episode, we're talking about all things to be in Ren, so sit back and enjoy the KanjiCast, the show that didn't make the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs, but does provide an Asian perspective into the galaxy far, far away. And, well, welcome to everyone to our official first episode. We survived the pilot, Cole!
Hooray! Yay!
All right.
Jay, that was the most unexcited I've ever heard anyone sound.
I am tremendously excited, and I think it comes across to the audience.
Are you sure?
I've never been sure of anything.
I feel like I need to tell you that. Do the dance. Wait, was it the new war? The dance of joy? Is that what it is, Brian?
Numfa, do the dance of joy.
Thank you.
I don't know what that is. And I'm referring to joy, by the way.
Damn it, Jay.
We'll have to educate you about that later. But I think before we start to kick everything off, we did want to thank everyone who has listened to the first episode we did of the show and for the incredibly positive feedback we've been receiving. I don't think any of us really expected that. It was pretty overwhelmingly positive, and I think I speak for all of us when I say that we're hoping we can keep bringing you a great show and give our, well, three Asian people's point of views on the galaxy far, far away.
Personally, I was mostly hoping for we'd just be politely ignored.
I'm just glad we got at least one listener.
I think we got more than one.
Incredible. Let's keep it going.
My expectations are so low.
We might have even had like five. I don't know. I don't actually look at the numbers.
Damn.
Yeah. I need to never make that sound again. I'm so sorry, guys. Okay, so we're going to start off with a section that I made a note, need to name this, and then did not come up with an appropriate KanjiCast section name for, but I just titled it Relevant Nerd World News. Brian, do you want to explain this one for us?
Give me a second. I'm rubbing my temples here. So was it last week, this little bit of information made its way through kind of the publishing and editorial circles that I follow on Twitter, and I'm just going to read this tweet verbatim. Wow, editors rejected Leonard Chang's novel because his Korean-American characters, quote, didn't act Asian enough.
Yeah. Yikes.
So I'm just going to read this editor's note that got Leonard Chang posted just so you can get an insight into why I said a lot of things that really can't be repeated on a mostly family friendly podcast like this. The part of the note that author Leonard Chang got from his editor was, the characters, especially the main character, just do not seem Asian enough. They have to they act like everyone else. They don't eat Korean food, they don't speak Korean, and you have to think about ways to make these characters more, quote, ethnic, more different. We get too much of the minutiae of the characters' lives and none of the details that separate Koreans and Korean Americans from the rest of us. For example, bear with me.
I know the part you got to.
In the scene where she looks into the mirror, you don't show how she sees her slanted eyes or how she thinks of her Asianness.
Ugh. Yeah.
Bria, do you look in the mirror every morning like I do just to remark and take stock of if your eyes are still slanted enough?
I mean, no, usually it's me looking in the mirror and going, damn it, I need to do my eyebrows again. Why couldn't I have got my mom's genetics with thin eyebrows? But that's not my eyes. I never really... No, it's bad. And it's not just bad because they said slanty. Like, don't do that. Please.
We don't exist to be exotic for you. God dang it.
I mean, you guys don't walk around thinking about how different you are and how you represent an entire continent every moment of every waking lives?
No, mostly I just think about Star Wars all day.
You stole my answer, dang it. I mean, mostly I just try to think of how much more I can piss people off with my love for Aiden Versio. Like, that's really my goal in life. What can I say? Yeah. But I think that does kind of lead us to a point that I think we've sort of been casually trying to make in the first episode, and we'll probably make in this episode, that there's no one right way to be Asian. There aren't two right ways to be Asian. And I think that sort of helps create the issue when people say things like there is no Asia in space. Because, well, I mean, yes, you're correct, but there are people who appear to be of Asian descent in space. And I can promise you, they also don't think about their otherness and how, you know, their eyes look or what their skin tone is compared to others every time they look in the mirror.
Yeah, well, you know what? There's no Europe in space either, so I don't see why there has to be so many white people in science fiction.
Well, the thing about this thing in particular is, like, this character in this novel pitch, I guess, was just acting like a regular person. That was apparently what was the editor's problem, whereas what we've been talking about, both with the intro episode talking about Aiden, and I think what we'd be talking about going forward is, we want characters that would appear Asian to just be treated the same way as any other character in Star Wars. Now, people sometimes talk about erasing different experiences and that sort of thing. And certainly for different people, they might want to highlight their Asian character and they wouldn't want that washed away. But there is no one size fits all answer. And what works for us does not work for everyone else either.
But like for this editor, what is the bar for being appropriately Asian? What are they expecting?
I don't know, but now I really want to kind of make a t-shirt that says inappropriately Asian.
You make that. I will buy it.
It's going to be a 2-pack. Inappropriately Asian and Raceline was right.
Yeah, I'll buy that. I will buy it. But yes, Asian representation in fiction. Let's get to a macro point where it's you don't have Asian representation just so you can have something, quote, exotic in your story. We're people. I don't go around remarking about how Asian I am every day, and I don't eat just Cambodian food all day.
That's good, because then you'd be missing out on tacos, and tacos are great.
Tacos are wonderful, and I'm sorry, but if someone was writing fictional me would be consuming a vast amount of tacos.
I got very jealous of those breakfast tacos in the picture that Nancy tweeted the other day. Like, I really wanted to eat those tacos.
Those breakfast tacos were perfection.
Could you imagine if nobody in fiction was allowed to eat tacos if they didn't belong to a particular ethnic group? That would be horrifying.
It's like the darkest timeline of all time.
A world without tacos.
So, man. Yes, editors, Asian people are allowed to eat tacos, and we don't stare at our eyes remarking on how slanty they are.
Ever.
Ever.
You'd think people would get used to them, their own eyes being however old these characters are, you know, just their eyes.
Their eyes, yeah. I've had them for 29 years. I don't think about them.
Brian, are you sure that's actually your eye, or did you play around a sabacc and get a slightly used one?
Okay, we are not revisiting Crucible ever.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm not that sorry.
Okay, no. Bad, Bria. Moving on.
I know. I'm sorry. Should we talk about Sabine Wren tonight instead?
Let's talk about Sabine Wren tonight.
This is how I'm going to get kicked out of lead the podcast role and bring up Crucible. But yes, okay. So Sabine Wren, as we're actually recording this, probably the last episode of the first half of this final season of Rebels is airing, or will be airing. So we've gotten to see what, nine episodes so far? I can't count. Seven?
It's either seven or nine. I can't remember how many weekends of Rebels I've had before this.
I can't count, which is ironic given the subject of this podcast. But so with Sabine, we wanted to take the chance to, number one, have her be our first character choice to discuss. And then number two, because of the timing of this, we thought she would be an ideal choice. So let's start off with our very first impressions of Sabine. Going all the way back to when the crew, I can't remember if it was Dave or who it was, first tweeted that picture of her and we got to meet her. What did you guys think?
So it's funny because I think this came up on Twitter recently when people were talking about how they were wrong about Sabine and initially had bad impressions. So I actually went and looked up to see what my first reaction was, and it was positive. I apparently said that I was excited to see a different kind of Mandalorian. I was interested in this graffiti art looking thing, and I was interested to see a story about a woman Mandalorian. So apparently I was positive from day one, which I was glad to hear.
Brian?
The first thought I had was, holy crap, this is going to be my sister's favorite character whenever she gets around to watching Rebels, because she looks a lot like my sister.
Has she gotten to watch Rebels yet?
She has not, but this Christmas she will be getting all three seasons on Blu-ray, and I am getting her the iTunes subscription for the final season.
Excellent.
And yes, I do have a feeling Sabine will be her favorite.
Probably. So my first impression was actually, it's not necessarily great in retrospect, but at the time I remember there was a slight moment of, oh God, please don't let her be an alien, because that is completely on par for Star Wars. And well, I was very relieved when they were like, no, don't worry. Like, she's human. She's a multiracial human. Don't worry about it. And I just remember this giant sense of, oh, okay. Well, this is safe.
That really goes to show how we've been conditioned to expect anyone who looks vaguely non-white, we expect them to be an alien, because there's no way we'd ever get to see ourselves on screen, right?
Well, even the ones we did see on screen were later retconned to be aliens, like Adi Gallia's species, which I still don't know what possessed them to do that.
No one does. I say between her and then Barriss and Luminara, I think prequels, while I love them, they did burn us.
I mean,
just a little bit.
We could probably have a discussion on some of the surprisingly problematic race representation stuff of the prequels at some point down the line, but that's another episode entirely.
Yeah. Instead, so let's fast forward to now, though, since we are talking about Sabine and not an audience. What do we think about Sabine now? Like, how have our first impressions changed?
Honestly, she's had my favorite character growth arc of the entire cast, and I just wish there had been more of her throughout the season, or throughout the seasons. I think she's many of my favorite episodes are Sabine focused episodes, and we're kind of nearing the end of the show, and I just keep thinking to myself, man, I wish we'd gotten more of this throughout.
Yeah, I think it took the show a while to give Sabine the kind of exposure the other characters, especially Ezra, got. And while I still don't believe the statement that people said that she would have the same role as Ezra did, or if that was ever an official statement or just a rumor, it's good to see that Sabine has actual episode arcs, and not just the episodes on her family, but that she's been able to be the lead character on several episodes and be one of the most dynamic parts of the team.
I feel like we should just go ahead and jump ahead to all of the stuff from last season with the Darksaber and her family and going back to Mandalore. And also, I really feel like I need to point out, I'm not doing this on purpose, but as we're recording this episode, I am like tossing up and down a foam version of a thermal detonator. And I feel like that's the most Sabine thing I could be doing right now.
I need a foam thermal detonator.
It is the best thing ever. But sorry, going back on topic, this is why I should not be in charge of leading this podcast. The Trials of the Darksaber, I think, was my favorite episode of second favorite episode of the entire series, because it let us get to know Sabine in a way that we hadn't before and sort of see a different side of her, where we found out that there was sort of this guilt and this sadness that she carried with her. And it really hit me.
And it was a slow reveal too. Like, we knew since season one that she had some history with the Imperial Academy and that something happened to her family. We didn't know what. And it took you know, 3 seasons to get to learn about it. But when it did, I think the payoff was huge because we realized that all her trust issues, all her issues with the Empire, it all stems from her history and what happened to her. And there was a reason she was tight-lipped about it, and it came out during her training with Kanan.
Which, the whole training scene with Kanan might be, that's got to be a top three moment of the entire show's run for me.
Oh, yeah. And the acting from both Tia and Freddie was absolutely incredible.
Yeah. And the music, too. I want that theme. They need to release it.
Yeah, that Kevin Kiner saved some of his best work for Sabine, and it was great. But
so what?
Go ahead.
Nope, go ahead.
So another thought that I'd had about Sabine is, I wish they'd really developed her sooner on, because as we saw towards the latter half of season 3 and so far through season 4. She's a great foil to Ezra and makes Ezra a lot more tolerable.
Yeah, I think that episode where they were dealing with a giant kyber crystal comes to mind immediately as far as being a good foil for him.
And I just think of all the earlier episodes, too, where she was always putting Ezra in his place and sort of saying, you know, you have to earn your high self-regard and, you know, Sabine's always just whenever Sabine says something, she sort of justifies it with her actions.
Yeah. Well, what about the other family stuff they sort of brought to the forefront with Sabine, especially like once they went back to Mandalore?
You know, I was dreading that they were going to play up daddy issues with Sabine, so I was actually a little relieved that it was a more contentious relationship between Sabine and her mother, kind of for no other reason than it kind of, that hits home for me for my frequently contentious relationship with my very Cambodian mother.
But then also at the same token, I was sort of relieved that her at the end of the day, her family did support her, right?
Absolutely,
like her brother supported
yeah.
her,
yes.
her mother supported her, her father supported her, because it would have been so easy to have her be alienated and have that pain and carry it through. And they didn't go there.
Yeah, I'm so glad they didn't. And that rang true to me. And I'm very glad that they decided to go that route rather than leaning into what could have been a much more grim, sad family relationship there.
I mean, thank goodness they didn't, you know, keep things how they were at the end of the episode we saw at Celebration.
How dare they do that to us?
Oh, God. I'm still traumatized.
Yeah, so if you don't know what happened at Celebration when they screened the premiere for the audience for the clone or the Rebels panel, they screened the premiere.
They
or, yeah, they screened that was Freudian.
A little bit.
They screened the premiere, but only the first.
Wait, hold on. Back up to what they did before this, because I think the whole emotional whiplash they took us through in those last like 10 minutes of the panel really play into how we felt.
Oh yeah, let me see if I can do a Dave voice here. We're gonna be ending Rebels after season 4. Here's the premiere, everyone.
No, here's the trailer.
Yeah, here's the trailer, and then here's the premiere.
And add in a little bit of Ahsoka trolling in the meantime.
Dave. So, yeah, the entire audience was kind of on the verge of emotional catastrophe watching the first episode. And then it ends with what looks like the majority of her family getting incinerated.
Yeah, we only got to see the first half of that premiere. So we had to live with May, June, July, August, September, 5 months,
mm-hmm.
5-6 months of thinking, oh, God, they did that. They really just killed her mother and her brother. And oh, it's kind of her fault in a way. Oh,
yeah, and the way they shot it, like especially the first time watching it, it looked like there was absolutely no chance they made it out, right? We didn't expect them to pull a "oh, they survived" thing, because it didn't look like there was any chance of that.
Yeah,
Yes.
It was just, ugh.
Yeah, it was mean. It was very mean. And if you're wondering why we all walked shell-shocked out of that hall, that's why.
And then we'd hang on to it and not tell anyone for months. And that was also hard bottling that in.
Dave, yeah, that bastard.
Basically. I mean, thankfully, everything turned out okay. And I think there were some very profanity-laced text messages that went between all of us, plus Nancy, after we saw the entirety of the premiere.
Just a few. I think I tweeted the troll in the dungeon gif on Twitter.
That's accurate. But obviously, you know, obviously they made it out okay. And I did, this is sort of not very bad segue, but I did want to point out how much I love that her dad is the one who married into the Clan Ren.
Yes.
And it's just like, yeah, what up? I'm here. I loved my wife. She's awesome and badass. I took her name. No big deal.
Ah, so good.
And Ursa just in general is a really, really cool character. Just the way she sort of held court in the first episode you saw her and the, you know, the giant majestic painting she had. Sorry, that's typical me, of course.
Did you want to go on about the art a little bit, Jay?
Hashtag on brand.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the Klimst art, like it was literally homage to the Austrian school of painting. And it, you know, I'm so glad they released the official art, the actual concept art of that on the website. But it was a really nice touch.
Bria, I'm proposing a new monthly segment, Jay's Art Corner.
I'm down with it.
I'm always game.
Oh, no, no, no. I don't think you understand. Now you have to do it.
Wait, what do you mean?
That's going to be an official segment on the podcast now.
Oh, no. What have I done?
You agreed to something before thinking.
Never agree to things, people, especially when you're being recorded.
We do have evidence now.
We certainly do. And soon all of our listeners will have it.
Yes, they will. But I think that leads us into the juxtaposition of Sabine as both an artist and a warrior. And we actually had a couple people tell that to KanjiCast. That just sounds really, I'm sorry, I can't say that without laughing. But we had a couple people sort of, we asked everyone what we should talk about. They had any questions for us. Nancy mentioned that she wanted to talk about how Sabine and Thrawn make such good foils. And then Nerf said, I like how art is an active form of resistance. I like how art as an active form of resistance is well represented by Sabine, especially how she uses art to physically fight. And Jay, I think that next note on there is from you.
Yep. Yeah, the Star Wars propaganda book basically used Sabine as a Star Wars equivalent of Banksy and hinted that her art had a larger impact on Imperial propaganda efforts, and the Empire even tried to counterfight with art of their own, which is really cool.
Well, I mean, art inherently is political and subversive, and when crafted right, is a very active act of resistance. And so I love that the writers of Rebels just leaned into Sabine saying that her art is such an important part of her resisting this tyrannical government, and it's so good.
Yeah, especially Nerf's point about how she uses art to physically fight. Like, it's not just that she uses it as a symbol of resistance or a symbol of hope, but, you know, her spray paint is explosive. Her explosions trigger in multiple colors, so it works on, or even her painting her armor and not making it, or painting the TIE fighter, making the generic white TIE fighter look like it's multicolored. That's her fighting the Empire in multiple different ideological and levels of warfare.
I think, wasn't her very first short that they showed us the one where she is blowing up TIE fighters with fun colored bombs?
Yes,
that
Art
was, yep.
That was fun. I felt like that was a great way to introduce her character. Like, it's her with also the whole, without quite the family trauma that we find out later on. I think it's also worth mentioning, there was a really cool book they put out back when the show first started the Sabine's journal, her art journal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, actually, our friend of the show, I think we actually interviewed her on the Tashi Station, Annie Stoll. She did the artwork in it, which was really, really neat because you get to see all the different styles and then the influences that she has on her art. And then when her and her dad are talking, when they meet up again for the first time, they're just like talking art criticism and being like, oh, yes, this was the influence. Or don't you see that? And I thought that was a really neat way to make the universe feel very lived in.
Yeah, and very big, because to go back to the propaganda book for a second, the guy who's the in-universe narrator of the propaganda book is the person whose art Sabine was inspired by to do resistance pieces. And then you learn through the course of the book that that guy, in turn, after retiring after the Clone Wars, was inspired by Sabine's resistance to start resisting the Empire again. And it shows that Sabine's art has a larger influence beyond just the show. She actually made a huge difference in the way the actual Galactic Civil War was fought.
And that is such a great way to just have her impact in this universe just extend out beyond what's happening in Rebels. Even if we never see Sabine do anything with the Rebellion after Rebels, that her just knowing that her art inspired resistance is It speaks a lot to today's, let's just say, modern political landscape.
Yeah, and even within the story, I think in tonight's episode, one of the pilots actually had her version of the Starbird on her helmet in like a dark blue color, unless I was hallucinating this morning.
I will have to go back and see, but I think I saw that.
Yeah, there were two of them on the front, I think. And I think that was really neat to see the spread of her artwork just within the fledgling Rebel Alliance. Kind of going back to one of the questions we got from Nancy about how Sabine and Thrawn make good foils, I actually think she's been really underutilized as far as contrasting over Thrawn has been this season. Or, well, the past two seasons, really.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a couple moments in which he's analyzing her art, but oh, that feels like a missed opportunity.
Yeah,
to,
I mean,
just have them have this thread through a season or two where they're just kind of having this, for a lack of a better way to phrase it, artistic warfare with each other.
Yeah, it's surprising actually that they didn't go there, because it seemed such an obvious and appropriate direction to take it. Like, we've seen Thrawn and Hera be kind of adversaries, which also seems appropriate given their leadership roles. But the art thing, especially since we know that Sabine is sort of a tactician, the tactician of the group, she's academy trained, she has all this technical expertise, to see Thrawn trying to manipulate her with her art and maybe her picking up on it and trying to do something back to him, that would have been a great layer of psychological warfare that we didn't get to see in this show.
Yeah, I mean, I did appreciate when they go back to Lothal and you see her when she's flying that terrible TIE fighter, which I shall not name because it's a ugly design.
The TIE Defender is wonderful.
It's ugly, Jay. From the side, it's pretty. When you look on it straight on, it's got those three little wings, and it is ugly as sin.
Well, don't worry. When you're looking at it straight on, you'll be blown up soon anyway, so that's fine.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is going to be like the one time I agree with Jay's Imperial thoughts. The TIE Defender is some sexy, sexy starfighter engineering.
Okay, first of all, both of your opinions are trash, and I just want to point that out right now. And second of all, can we at least all agree that Y-Wings are garbage?
Yes. Well,
yes.
Okay.
That's a universal accepted truth.
Some people got really mad at me the both times I made fun of Y-Wings.
But they are garbage.
I know. The garbage will not do. But that's not the point. I wanted to say that when she's flying that TIE Defender, that I really enjoyed how Thrawn was able to figure out that it was her flying and not Ezra.
Oh my god, that was incredible. Ezra isn't good enough. Yeah.
Shade!
And also, I mean, we're talking about Sabine, but also that he figured out later in the episode that it wasn't Hera flying, because Hera would have been much better. That was really, really cool, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wish there was that extra little bit of artistic flair throughout. But
are you talking about, You're not talking about the red stripes, are you?
Jay.
I had to.
I just want to point out that they repainted that trash thing with yellow stripes for the latest episode, and it was highly inferior.
Yeah, it's the mining guild color. What I mean, I know that that pilot guy uses yellow, but that's just not a pretty color. Sorry, we're getting distracted, but it's about art. Sabine would approve.
Oh, well, actually, kind of going off of yellow and dealing with all that. Did you notice that she's for her paint scheme for her armor this year? It has more yellow in it, and I think it kind of reflects the House Wren colors.
Oh, you know, I had not noticed that.
Yeah, I noticed it was different, but not the House Wren connection. That's really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
All right.
So I think it's more yellow and more purple, which, I mean, I have an aversion to yellow, but I do appreciate that they put that thought in and they gave her, you could see her making that extra effort to represent that she's closer to her family again.
I mean, her armor tells a story because each season it changes. But if you look at what they add to it, it always reflects what she's gone through, right? Like in season 3, they added that force owl thing or whatever that is to the shoulder. And I guess in season 4, the family notations and that kind of thing.
I was kind of hoping, do they have a house crest? I feel like they should. If they're going to go all like making her a countess, then there should be a house crest. Jay?
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a house crest, just the trim on the armor as far as I've noticed.
That's unfortunate.
Although, okay, next convention that someone finds Dave Filoni at, please send your child up to ask about the yellow on her armor this season.
It's the only way we get answers.
It's the only way we get answers from Dave. Ambush him, Brian, with your children.
Brian, I have a mission for you.
Mm-hmm.
When you and Nancy adopt, we're going to need to use your child for this.
Oh, no. Our child will be trained from a young age to ambush Dave Filoni with deep, thought-provoking questions.
Excellent. Thank you. We appreciate your sacrifice and your commitment to the art. Pun not intended. I'm really ashamed of myself. I'm sorry. Listen, it's not as bad as the Mr. Bones pun that we all learned about today.
How did we all miss that? Sidebar. Mr.
I'm
Bones
so mad.
From the Aftermath books is a B1 droid. B-O-N-E.
Yeah, we all thought he was the other kind of battle droid. Apparently not. And it was right in his name the whole time.
It was right in front of us the whole time. Damn you, Chuck.
And now all I have in my head is Captain Raymond Holt going, "Bone!" And it's my own fault. If you don't watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, this is going to be a very strange part of the podcast.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, if you haven't caught on by now, we will make all sorts of weird pop culture references. I got bad news for you.
That's great news, if you ask me.
I'm down with it.
Wait, Jay, have you seen that episode?
I have not seen Brooklyn Nine-Nine at all.
Okay, at some point, remind me after the podcast ends, and I'm going to send you the YouTube video, and you're going to watch it before we hang up this call.
Okay.
But back to, what were we talking about? The art?
Something about track. Sabine.
Sabine. Oh, hey, here's something we didn't talk about yet in the show notes. Do we want to talk about her as being part of the ghost crew? Since we've talked about her, like, her biological family. So let's talk about her found family.
I can't talk about this with getting really sad that the whole found family angle got so dropped the last two seasons. Because Sabine's relationship and chemistry with the rest of the crew, that first season and a half was so good, and then that all just kind of went by the wayside.
Right, like she was big sister to Ezra, but then also she had her tensions with Mom, and they had that episode where they went to Fort Anaxes, and you know, can you tell me about the rebels and who Fulcrum is? And that whole thing was such a great relationship. And even, I mean, we see hints of it later on with her relationship with Kanan, but it's sort of that whole family vibe kind of disappeared as time went on.
Well, now I'm sad, guys.
I need all of the found family fic. Just give me all the fluffy found family ghost crew fic, because I didn't get enough of it in Rebels.
Especially before the rest of the show traumatizes us, because we know it will.
Yeah.
I'm already preparing to rewrite Hamilton lyrics for the occasion. Oh, the who lives, who dies, who tells your story. I'm prepared.
I'm waiting for empty chairs at empty tables.
Oh, no.
I'm hoping it doesn't get that far, but fingers crossed.
Yeah. I did really enjoy the sort of parental / sibling relationship that she had with both Kanan and Hera, especially in the whole Darksaber episode. And actually, he's not a part of the Ghost Crew, but Fenn Rau, I want to nominate him for like best adopted uncle of the year. Like, sorry, Zeb, you're out of the running.
Well, the thing is,
Fenn Rau came in and was like, hey, I got you some cool gauntlets. Use them and kick Ezra's butt. And I'm like, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
But Zeb isn't adopted uncle. Zeb is very much big brother.
Okay. Yes, but that's not the point. The point is that Fenn Rau knocked both everyone but Kanan and Hera out of the running for the best, like, found family relationship when he did that. And then when he's back on, when they're on Mandalore in the second half of the episode, and he's just like, yeah, that's my girl. I'm her number one fan. Everyone appreciate her as much as me.
Well, especially Fenn Rau since when they first met.
The biggest Sabine stan of them all.
Especially yes. Considering when they first met and the whole growth in that relationship, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And how they played, was it Dejarik together or was it some other?
It was some game of chance.
I thought it was a strategy game.
Was it? Now I got to go back and look.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I feel like Sabine. I feel like Chance is more Ezra. Are we all Googling this right now? Sabine. Fenn Rau. The wonders of the internet, guys. What did we do before this?
Had endless arguments at bars.
Yeah. Actually, I remember back before, like, everyone had internet on their phone. You and me and our friend Maggie got into this giant, or you kind of got pulled into it, a giant debate to what, like, Kel Tanner's hair color.
So yeah. Wikipedia says it's cubic cod or something. It looks like the word cubic with AD at the end. So it's a Mandalorian game played with holograms.
Sorry, I heard it that looks... is Q-bert.
Cubic cod. I gotcha. Can't pronounce Mandalorian.
It looks like it looks like more like a strategy game. Like there's some pointy things in there.
Apparently it's a old Karen Travis invention from Legends.
Really?
Yeah, there's a Legends tab on the entry. That's surprising.
Huh. I'm on the Rebels wiki by accident. But yeah, okay, I'm going to call it a game of strategy because I can. But yeah, going back to the point of like how they built that relationship up was really good. And I think that, all right, can I get into my Mandalore rant?
Absolutely.
Okay. If you follow us on Tashi Station, you probably saw my column a couple weeks ago about how the Mandalorian culture is not great in canon, and it's due mostly to how the Clone Wars whitewashed the crap out of it, and Rebels tried to walk that back, but also made some very colonial-sized missteps. And that all culminated at the end of, was the episode called Heroes of Mandalore? Heroes of Mandalore, with Bo-Katan raising the Darksaber and leading the people of Mandalore. To which I say, rah, rah, she's our girl, yay. Because Sabine should have been the new Mandalore. And I get really mad that this did not happen. Really mad.
Like,
yeah, I honestly thought her arc was going there, especially after Trials of the Darksaber and all the things she'd learned. And, you know, Bo-Katan flying in at the last second, you know, even if it makes continuity people happy, it felt like she was becoming a bystander in her own story at the expense of a Clone Wars character. Like, or because of a Clone Wars character.
I'm actually okay with Sabine having the agents to say, you know what, this role isn't for me. But if they were going to go that route, that title should have stayed with Clan Ren.
I feel like they walked us too far down the path of, hey, she could be the new Mandalore. And then Bo-Katan flew in. And I was disappointed.
Yeah,
because I love Sabine. Like, I really do. And I'm glad we're getting to see her in this season. But all the lead up, I was like, come on, let her lead her people, please.
Yeah, because it's absolutely okay for her to decide this is not for me, this is not who I am, or this is not what I want to do. But they put her on that arc and they took her basically to the finish line, and then they pulled her off, and it didn't seem like it followed the direction that they were leading her in.
Yeah, and I do wonder what would have happened had they not gone back to the Clone Wars well, and instead of having Bo-Katan show up and preordained fate, introducing just another character entirely that Sabine selects herself to take this mantle.
Especially after they told us, you know, the Darksaber is, you know, something you earn, right? And then, so, yeah, and it feels weird that I'm saying this, but even though Bo-Katan is the legitimate heir, that doesn't matter inside Mandalorian culture. They went through the effort to show us that. So after Sabine earned it through the rules of her culture, it seems like they went the other way.
Please mark down the time and date. Jay spoke in favor of something that was not a hereditary monarchy.
Listen, I've always supported cultural
mark the
legitimacy.
Time. I just want to note it is 9:16 p.m. on November 13th, and Jay has in fact said what he just said. It's on the record now, Jay. You can't walk back from it.
Yeah, but I will say, on the one hand, again, I'm cool with Sabine having the agency to say, I don't want this. This isn't for me. But to have Bo-Katan just show up and just have it fall into her lap, there were better ways to go about the idea of Sabine having the choice.
And I did want to read another one of the comments we got from one of our listeners, Kate from Book Wars Pod. So what she said was, as presented on Rebels and Clone Wars, Mando culture has a lot in common with stereotypes of Japanese warrior culture. Would love to hear your thoughts about how that can be problematic and how the first canon Asian Mando character fits into all of that.
Well, I mean, in addition to just Mando culture, it's a lot of Star Wars that borrows heavily from stereotypes of Japanese warrior culture.
The Jedi, anyone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That said, it's, I mean, for me, it's at least nice to see Sabine get introduced, because for me, that's a little bit of an acknowledgement that they had appropriated some of this cultural stuff for this saga. And to put someone like Sabine in that role is at least for me a little bit of a nod that they acknowledge that.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about Star Wars and cultural appropriation, because it's all cultural appropriation.
Oh, yeah.
And it's
yeah.
all really bad if you sit down and think about
it. It's wall-to-wall cultural appropriation.
But, you know, going forward, you know, now that we're more aware of this issue as a society, it's something that I think we have to be more careful about. And certainly I think with Sabine, it was a chance for them to show, and not just the fact that it's appropriating Japanese warrior culture, but sort of the ties that it had to Maori culture, especially in the pre-canon reboot version of things, and for them to actually make sure that they're acknowledging their sources and being respectful about it is very important.
Yeah, I mean, can they improve on how they're acknowledging that? Yeah, definitely, absolutely. But having a Sabine is an important thing to do for me, at least.
Do you guys think that it? Yeah. Do you guys think that helps in any way make up for the drastic whitewashing of Mandalore that we saw in the Clone Wars?
I mean, no. Sabine is kind of addressing earlier Star Wars, but come 2005 to 2009, wow, we should have been better about that. And the whitewashing was way more in it. The whitewashing was way more inexcusable come Clone Wars.
Yeah, and you can't ever really take back what happened. It's there, both in terms of history and the fact that it's a part of canon. But it's, I think, you know, they went through the effort of trying to fix it, I think, with Sabine and the other Mandalorians we saw in Rebels. But Bria, as you pointed out in your column, the unfortunate thing is the way they went about it almost ended up making it worse.
Yeah. Honestly, my biggest, besides the whitewashing, but one of the things I think is a shame is that the version of the Mandalorian Haka got, and I think I'm not pronouncing that right, so I'm very sorry, but that kind of got wiped out of canon with the Legends reboot, because that was so cool. Like, wouldn't you just love to see a bunch of Mandalorian warriors just doing the Haka? Like, how cool would that be?
Yeah, I mean, it's a respectful nod to the portrayal of the character. And there's been a lot of discussions on Twitter about how Temuera Morrison is almost never used to voice the clones anymore. And you know, there could be a lot of reasons behind it, financial, maybe he's busy, who knows. But it's just an unfortunate consequence that the Maori aspect of Mandalorian culture doesn't seem to be as acknowledged as it should.
Yeah, I will say with Temuera Morrison voicing clone stuff. This is probably not popular to say, but I really wish it had been him in Rebels and that they didn't bring back D. Bradley Baker. However, over on the Battlefront video game side, video game voiceover work is brutal. And that, for all we know, that they did approach him for that, but video game VO work is nasty. It's brutal. It kills a lot of VO artists' vocal cords, so that may not have been in the picture. I wish they could have found another Maury VO artist for it, but I at least get why it wasn't Tim Morrison in Battlefront.
They did use him for Boba, though, so that's...
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad they did that, at least.
Yeah. So do you guys want to talk about... is there anything else about Sabine, like, in-universe you guys want to talk about, or do you want to shift to the more meta look at her out-of-universe?
I'm good talking about the sort of out of universe meta stuff here.
Same.
Okay. Go.
All right. Since I put this on the outline, I guess I'll introduce the topic.
Yes.
But I want to talk about Sabine's out of universe role. Like, you know, first of all, it's the amount of toys and merchandise of her: masks, helmets, several action figures, you know, the Black Series, the small action figures, and the impact that has on fans, especially younger fans, who I think, you know, we've talked about representation and seeing yourself in the Star Wars and seeing a Sabine action figure or a pop where it's not just her, but her helmet's removable so she can see what the character looks like. And also the impact that might have on people dressing up as Sabine in costumes and going to conventions and seeing little Sabines everywhere.
Well, I will always say that my heart grows three sizes every time an underrepresented group of children finally get a costume for them. And in this case, it's young Asian girls who are fans of science fiction and fantasy. That is terribly underserved, and I am just thrilled to pieces that they will have a Sabine now and moving forward that they can costume as.
I wish we had had her when I was a kid. Like, 8-year-old Bria would have lost her... I don't think I can say that word on the podcast. Lost her stuff. Lost her mind. There we go. If I could have gotten to be Sabine when I was, like, 10. I just...
How would a 10-year-old you have reacted to Sabine? Just as a whole.
I don't think my parents would have liked it. Because I'm pretty sure it would have involved, like, art terrorism to the house. Which really would not have gone well with my mom. But, I'm pretty sure I probably would have gotten in trouble for trying to dye my hair. But I think that it would have been incredibly amazing to see her on the screen. And I think it would have been also been very, very moving to see Ursa and Sabine on the screen together. Like, that's the first time I think I've really seen like an Asian mom and daughter in Star Wars. And that was a big deal, even though my mom won't wear an Ursa Ren costume if I make it for her, which is really a shame.
Oh, that's tragic.
Isn't it? I was like, Mom, you can have armor. You'll be badass. Like, you're already a badass, but like, you'll be more badass. And she was like, no.
Aww.
Thanks for asking, but no. I tried. But yeah, but I mean, like, just like you, Brian, I think every time I see a young Asian girl running around a con in a Sabine costume, I get so happy because they finally have someone that they can dress up as and who, like, they won't be like, oh, look at that little Asian girl over there being Rey. Isn't she cute?
Right. Or even being called Asian Rey.
Yeah.
One thing I wonder is, you know, for us, it seems so refreshing and unusual, but I wonder, and maybe I hope, but do kids see the fact that there are Asian characters in Star Wars as normal now? Like, do they grow up thinking, of course they're in Star Wars, why wouldn't they be?
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too. And at the very least, Sabine goes a long ways to help normalize that. And that is the most important thing, and the thing we're always lobbying for. That it's important to get this kind of representation, especially in entertainment geared towards children, preteens, and young teenagers, that show different people, so that they can absorb different people, people who don't look like them, people who aren't quite like them, can be in these roles. You normalize this at a young age, and it just makes the world better. And Sabine is one of the great normalizing factors for Asian representation in genre media.
And one of the things that's really refreshing about Sabine's portrayal is that it's consistently clear that she's Asian, whether it's on the cartoon, whether it's in Forces of Destiny or a Forces of Destiny figure, or even the smaller Hasbro plastic figures. It is clear that she is an Asian character, and no matter how much people try to argue it, I think her portrayal is 100% consistent across all those mediums.
Yeah. And I think also it's important to point out that even though Sabine might be the only person of color in the line right now, that the Forces of Destiny line between the shorts and the toys is doing a heck of a lot to help normalize seeing just women in Star Wars. And it's really cool to see, to walk down the aisle, the toy aisle in Target and be like, oh my gosh, there's a Sabine doll there. I would have begged my mom to have that when I was a kid. It would have been the most amazing thing. She would have been my favorite.
I wish that there had been a Sabine 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled there is now, though.
Yeah, I mean, I take heart in the fact that the generation of kids right now aren't going to know a Star Wars world in which there aren't Asian heroes. Because between Sabine and then Rose in The Last Jedi, and then we had both Chared and Baze in Rogue One, and Bodhi. I cannot forget Bodhi. I'm so sorry. I think it's really, I mean, it's not perfect. I don't think any of us would ever say that representation is perfect in Star Wars, because boy, do they struggle some days. But I think that seeing these faces on the big screen is doing a heck of a lot of good, not just for kids out there, but also for adults who are slowly coming around to the, hey, this is something that's in Star Wars and in the world around us and that we should appreciate and recognize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, You just can't discount how important Sabine is just for existing in the Star Wars universe, and especially for being in a medium designed for kids. I am so incredibly thankful that Sabine is who she is, and that the writers and the producers made these conscious choices to make her this Asian representation on screen.
Yeah, because it would have been really easy not to, or to make her look more ambiguous, and they didn't. They were very clear about it, and kids can see that, and they can tell who she is, and both just the fact that she exists, but also that she's been such a strong and important character on the show as well.
Yeah. Okay, any more? Do we have any more thoughts about Sabine?
I have just kind of one last quick question, just to see how you feel on this.
Oh, boy.
Just because it's sort of something that sort of fanon, but never confirmed by anyone. is Sabine coded queer?
Ooh. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for this. I lean a little yes.
I lean towards, I don't think she's coded, but if they told us that her and Ketsu had a thing once or were like had ever been together, I'd be like, okay, mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah. I think Bri is on the ball with that. Like it's they don't the show, as far as I can tell, doesn't seem to lean either way, but it's something that would be 100% plausible. On what we've seen in the show.
I will go with that. I'll go with that reading as well.
I mean, if nothing else, she's 100% not Ezra sexual, so that's pretty great.
That I think we can all agree on.
Actually, her shooting down Ezra is one of my favorite things in this entire show.
It's been entertaining.
I'm sorry. I know we have some Ezra fans, but it's just fun. You know, it's she doesn't do it to be mean. It's just to knock him down a peg or two.
Well, and I do like that they've established more of a sibling relationship between them. That's not him trying to hit on her all the time.
Well, they have a much more enjoyable and likable relationship now, and I'm glad it's gotten to this point.
Yeah, definitely. All right, I got one question for you guys.
Okay.
Well, actually, hold on. I'm going to back up because within our Tell That to Kanji Cast notes, Mike Audette wanted us to talk about how she'd run circles around, and this is an exact quote, Boba Fett.
Okay, do you see Sabine falling into a sarlacc after getting whacked by a blind Han Solo? I don't think so.
I think she's just smarter than him. That's the thing. Like, she wouldn't even be in a situation where they'd be directly in direct combat. She could take him, I think, if they were fighting. You know, but I think she's just clever. Like, you know, I know Boba Fett's super powerful, but he's, you know, he got locked into a box in the Clone Wars. Come on. He's not that bright.
Oh, poor Boba. Okay, but that was not my actual last question. But since, again, we're recording this the night that the first half of the Rebels finale wraps up, and because we have to wait several long months before we get more episodes, what do you guys think is going to happen to her between now and the end of the season? Like, where do you think she's going to end up?
I mean, I don't know the specifics of what's going to happen to her this season, but I think that she has said, you know, leading Mandalore isn't for me, says that she's fully committed to the Rebellion. And I think she's with the Rebellion through Andor, at least.
Yeah, I think... And this is just my reading of the propaganda book. I think that she survives the show and takes on a larger role with the Rebel Alliance in their propaganda and communications efforts with people. And that, you know, maybe, you know, if we're lucky, there isn't a doom and gloom scenario for all the characters. They just sort of split apart and do different roles for the Rebellion. Hera the general and Sabine the propagandist. That's at least where I'd like to see it go.
Oh, yeah. I also don't think she kicks the bucket in Rebels. I mean, everyone gets on me for saying and accusing me of wanting everyone to die. I don't. I really want Sabine to survive, and we know Hera survives. I also want Zeb to survive, but I do think Sabine survives.
Yeah,
I think she does too. And I'm actually going to go contrary to what Brian says, and I think that there is an opportunity for her to go back and end up leading Mandalore. Because I think there could be a point at which she figures out that leading her people is what she needs to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
I could easily see Bo-Katan being really bad at it. and actually, that's not a slight against Bo.
I actually agree with you. I I think she does go back to Mandalore at some point. I think she does it after Endor.
Actually, here's what I really want to happen. I want, after the end of the war, when the Empire loses, Thrawn is in prison and Sabine visits him while he's under house arrest, and they talk about art just like Magneto and Professor X in X-Men 2.
God, I love that headcanon so much.
That's pretty good. I was going to make a quip about how Sabine and, oh my God, I just blanked on his name. Thane. There we go. Her and Thane can be like, let's go visit our friends in jail. They can share a cab ride out. But no, I think that there is a chance, and this could just be me holding on to a seasons old Sabine for Mandalore hope. But I think there's a chance they could do it. Like, I think it'd be very interesting if they did. And I think she would make a good ruler because she knows what's up. And it'd be a great further redemption arc for her from how, not like that she necessarily needs redemption, but like from when she was making weapons like the Duchess.
Yeah, and I agree. And I just wonder if that story would work well in a post-Return of the Jedi era when the whole galactic cleanup is sort of happening.
Ooh. I could explain where she is during the Battle of Jakku.
Mm-hmm. She, after Endor, she realizes that her responsibilities and duties and purpose with the Rebellion has been successfully completed. Then she heads back to Mandalore to start this next chapter in her life.
Oh, so everyone gets, basically everyone's story can happen under that plan.
Mm-hmm.
This is good. I like this, guys.
Hera goes to Ryloth, and Zeb goes back to wherever they went to beyond that star cluster.
That was such good music.
Yes.
Yeah. And Kanan and Ezra are dead. Sorry, boys.
Yeah, sorry, but they're dead.
They have to. Sorry.
But in the meantime, we've written this has been a very good, like, collaborative group fan fiction between us.
Hooray!
For how we think Sabine should go. All right. Any last thoughts that we have about Sabine or her, what she means representation?
Sabine's great, and I love that she exists.
Sabine for spinoff TV show.
Yes.
Yes. Brian, you're going to have to report back to us in our January episode or maybe our February one, what your sister thinks of her.
Oh, absolutely. That could be a regular report on this show.
Yes, that sounds perfect. All right. Excellent. You'll have to come up with a good name for it.
I'll think of something.
There we go. Okay. Shall we wrap it up then?
Let's wrap it up.
Okay. So thanks to everyone for joining us to talk about Sabine and what to listen to us talk about Sabine. You can join us for our next episode in December when we will be talking about Iden Versio and Battlefront 2, which I am anxiously counting down the hours till. Don't forget that if you have any questions for us for a future episode or just want to chime in, you can tweet them to us via the Tosh Station account and tell that to GanjiCast.
Excellent. Oh, right. I have to do the outros here because I'm versed in the outros. This episode of KanjiCast has been brought to you in part by you, our Patreon subscribers. Head over to patreon.com/ToshiStation. $1 gets you in at the patron-exclusive Slack team. $5 is our new tier. That gets you in for a mini podcast episode where you can ask Nancy and I over at TSR anything and get a chance to win some cool swag from us. We are a part of the Tosche Station Network. The Tosche Station Radio Mega Feed is where you can find this show and all of our other shows on the network. We're going to have a dedicated feed for this soon. We just need artwork. That's where to find all our stuff. On Twitter, you can find us with the hash handles Tosche_Station, official show account. You can find Bria with @ChaosBria. Jay is Admiral Jello, and I am Lane Winry, LaneWinree. Facebook, we're the Tosche Station Network. Again, find the mega feed on the iTunes Store, Google Play, and Stitcher. And you can find our columns and news at Tosche-Station.net. Catch you all next time.
Bye, guys.